Hello and welcome to The Best Show. I am Jason Gore. Tom is away for the next few weeks, so we'll be putting up some pre-records for you. And tonight, it is the Little Steven edition of Best Show Book Club that you've already heard on the Patreon if you subscribe to the Patreon. That's patreon.com/thebestshow. And it's a fantastic conversation about Little Steven's book, Unrequited Infatuations. Also, speaking of the Patreon, if you are subscribed to the Patreon currently, make sure you go in and update your address. Make sure your address is updated in the Best Show Patreon, because all Patreon subscribers, $5 and above, are going to get the brand new Best Show sticker. I saw it last week. It looks amazing. So make sure your address is updated in there. And also make sure you go over to patreon.com/thebestshow to support the show if you haven't done so already. We've got some really, really cool stuff coming up very, very soon, including the final episode of So Far, Meet My Friends the Friends, and a bunch of other stuff. So right now, here it is, Best Show Book Club, Steven Van Zandt.
Yeah, we're doing, this is the Best Show Book Club, and our book that we've all been excited about, and we've all read, and all loved, is Unrequited Infatuations, which is by a New Jersey legend, and even more than New Jersey legend at this point, an international superstar. I think we can round up and say the worldwide. We got Stevie Van Zandt. Thanks for doing that. And then we have the author himself here. This is so exciting. How are you?
Good to be here, my friend.
This is great. First of all, I guess we could start right off at the top of the book. It's Stevie Van Zandt. What makes Stevie versus Steven versus Little Steven versus Miami Steve? We're moving down the continuum here of name changes. Where are we going to end up?
I'm sure there'll be a few more too before we're done. That depends on what mood I'm in that day, you know?
It made me think of how, Mike Nesmith, he said that he's like, well, when I'm talking about the monkeys, you can call me Mike. That's Mike Nesmith. Anything else I did, that's Michael. Like he had hard lines on it. Just like, when it's the monkeys, I'm Mike Nesmith. Don't call me Mike if you're talking about the First National Band, though. That was Michael Nesmith. So
it's good to it's good to compartmentalize, you know. Especially when you're as schizophrenic as I am, you know, I got about 12 different personalities at least. So it's good to, you know, kind of keep track of them with, you know, different names.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Stevie wrote the book.
Yeah. I've been in a Stevie mood lately. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I guess we could start. What made you finally determine at this point in time that it was time to tell the whole story?
I think certainly circumstance had everything to do with it. I don't know if it ever would have gotten done if not for quarantine. So in the book, I thank Mr. Trump for that. I think also the last 3 years of my of the non-quarantine years, 17, 18, 19, were the most productive of my entire life. Mm-hmm. And that really, really helped, because I got reconnected to my life's work, which I had kind of abandoned for 30 years, you know, my music life, and got connected to it by accident, which is, you know, what most of my life is. And ended up having a very, very productive 3 years, you know, 6 album packages got released, 2 brand new albums, mm-hmm. Soul Fire and Summer of Sorcery, and 2 world tours. And, you know, it just kind of felt like a bit of closure, you know, because that could very well be my, you know, last tour, last record. Who knows? You know, every day, you know, you never know. And if that is the case, I kind of ended on a very, very positive note. So I felt enough closure to write a book and have a beginning, middle, and end, you know, of some kind, mm-hmm. at least for this chapter of my life. you know, it's the most, I'm still hoping for a big fourth quarter, but you know, we're
you got still a few more rounds, still more rounds to go. I'm not gonna sign off on this final tour talk.
Yeah, but anyway, so that was it, and I just got new managers. I never had a manager in my whole life, and I just got two, and they were very encouraging about writing the book. So the combination of those things just felt it was time to do it, especially since while I can still remember something, I probably only remember about 30%.
Look, 30 is high enough percentage. You fill in the other 70 for however that fits where you're at that day.
Exactly. Yeah.
Now, one of the things I want to ask you about the manager thing, which is a thread that does run through the book and it just speaks to who you are ultimately, is that you're someone who you know how you want it to be. And it seems like it's hard to have that letting go, to just have a true partner who can say like, I got this, and you can just exhale, let them run with the ball. It seems like you need to have your hands on the wheel for whatever it is you're doing. And that comes through in so much of the book. It seems like you trust yourself above everybody else.
Yeah. Certainly that's true. I don't know about need so much because I don't like it. You know, I don't like doing it. I don't like having that particular ability. And I greatly regret not having a manager my whole life.
It's that's the compulsion. And I understand that too. I have to do everything. Everything I have to, if I don't touch it, it's still not right until I get my mitts on it.
Yeah. And I everybody's different, and my ego does not work the way of, I've seen other people who, they want to be involved and they want their imprint on it, whether it needs it or not.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a whole other thing. Yeah.
I'm not that guy, If I could just sit there and let the world happen, believe me, I would love it, because my focus needs to be on the creative side of things, So if the business could just work without me, believe me, I would love it. But the problem is, in most cases, in the past, I've gotten a better deal than anybody else could have gotten, a couple of reasons for that, sometimes the companies or whoever you're doing business with are a little bit more reluctant to say no to the artist, Mm-hmm. So I've noticed that. And also I happen to be very good at it. Okay. I can usually, get the best deal of that situation, Mm-hmm. Now, having said that, of course, my business life has been completely chaotic because I wasn't playing along. The artist in me was not playing along with the businessman,
Sure. Keep changing hats.
Yeah. And not only that, but in the end, when you look at the book, my life is the triumph of art over commerce. it's supposed to work with it, art and commerce, we're supposed to find a way for those things to be married in order to be successful. And I think that is true. In my case, that's just not what happened. And I end up doing whatever art I have done, whatever work I have done has been in spite of the business in a way, and like I say, a crazy triumph of managing to survive all this time and do world tours and put out 7 albums without a single hit, which is a dubious achievement at best, but that's a fact, and that's just the way it turned out.
Sure. And it is the thing that you see the artistic side of it. And did you feel you had to kind of Did you feel you had an innate sense of the business side of it in you that was ready to come out? Or is that something you had to like really learn and develop over time?
No, it was just a defense, you know. I wasn't ever, you know, I don't see myself as uncommercial. You know what I mean? I don't really see myself as doing something that's so wildly off the commercial beaten path. I mean, when I was doing these things, looking back on it now, I mean, it's very clear that what I'm doing artistically is just in its own world. I mean, there is no relationship really between what I've been doing and the commercial world, not unless you go into a time machine. You know, I mean, it would have been commercial, 40, 50 years ago, maybe. But that's just the stuff. That's just the stuff I like, you know. So you end up doing what you love, and you hope you can find that common ground. You know, you hope you can find a common ground between what you're doing artistically and what is commercial. I mean,
we are in a world now. It's funny. We are in a world though. There are the ups and downs of that, where it's like it's not a world where it's just three channels anymore either. Like that. There's a middle class now for things that might not be able to work on the biggest stage, but it's not like all or nothing anymore. It's like you can find your stream and you can exist. You might not be the world's biggest thing, but at least there's a home for a lot more things now. I feel.
I mean, I don't really find that to be true in a sense of making a living. I think it's worse than ever. It's you're super big or you don't exist. I think in terms of actually making a living at it. You know, now what you're talking about in terms of middle ground. I mean, you can write a song and record it and put it out yourself. You know, in that sense, and there's a lot. There's more music than ever has ever existed, right now.
Yeah.
But the marketing rules don't change. You know, there's more music than ever, but how do you find it or who finds it? And when they find it, are they paying for it? Probably not. You know, so you can get your work out there, you know, in that sense of being middle ground. You know, you don't have to depend on a big record company or managers or lawyers. You know, you can get that done. Who's going to hear it? Who's going to buy it? Is that going to allow you to make a living from it? Probably not.
At least you can exist though in the world, and it's not just like the gatekeepers can't say no and then you go home and don't do your thing. You can at least do your thing, and at least you get a swing to see how far you can go with it.
True, but along with the gatekeepers, that's not all negative. There is a certain, you know, curation process. There's a certain development process that should go, and I go into great detail about this in the book.
Absolutely.
That should go along with your creation of content. You know, in the old days, and I would argue to some extent still, it takes an army to make a great record. Technically, technologically, that's no longer necessary. You can make a record all by yourself. Is it going to be as good as it if you do it with a great producer and a great arranger and a great band? I don't think so.
No, you know? Well, of course, no. That stuff is that's undeniable.
It's tough. It's still tough.
It's still tough. And look, I'm out there grinding still too. So it's and sometimes I'm like, what am I chasing here? How do you feel that you're in, how do you hold on to those enthusiasms? So those unrequited infatuations. And also I should say with the title, I heard when I was at the bookstore, a guy said, he's like, oh, is that unrequited infatuations? And it was just like, well, I guess you gave somebody a chance to go back to the dictionary and learn a new word.
Maybe so, but I mean, I wanted the book to be more than just a music book for music people. The first half of the book is pretty much that, you know, local kid from New Jersey makes it to the top of rock and roll. And that's great. That's a great story, you know, but it gets a little bit more interesting second half when I leave the band. And now you are staring into the abyss, and it becomes, you know, the bigger themes start to emerge, such as, you know, the search for identity, the search for, purpose, the search for spiritual enlightenment of some kind, of searching for that connection to the world, which I think most people go through sooner or later. And the truth is, as successful as I have been with Bruce Springsteen and E Street Band and Sopranos and Lilyhammer and the Sun City Project, the work that really has meant the most to me personally has not been successful, you know. So there is that, you know, that unrequited infatuation sense of sometimes the things you love the most don't love you back, you know. I think that's something that's true for everybody. You know what I mean? I wanted to emphasize the things that are true for everybody, you know, not just music people. And I think that everybody in their life ends up hitting that wall at some point or getting disappointed, and their first plan, you know, of their life doesn't work out. Mm-hmm. Okay, and what I wanted to emphasize was, you know, when I left the band, my life was over. I thought my life was over.
Okay.
I wasn't just changing jobs. My life ended. Okay. And yet everything I've accomplished since then. So the point being, when you think it's over, if you can find a way to keep going somehow and just move forward, no matter how slowly, no matter how disappointed you might be, mm-hmm. if you can find a way to move forward, destiny is going to surprise you.
Look, it's easy to say when it wasn't my life, you actually went through it, but it's like you can make a case that you would clearly not be the person that you are if you had not made that leap into the abyss. Like it seems like you needed to go into the abyss, but for good, bad, whatever, it's a road you needed to go down for you to come out the other side and realize who you were and what you wanted to do and open yourself up to all these new opportunities.
Yeah. And I think that search continues, mm-hmm. Frankly, because I never really did come out the other side. You know, I'm still looking for a steady job. it's not what it seems. But I didn't. It wasn't like I wanted to jump into this adventure. It was just something I did compulsively. You know, I was obsessed. With politics at the time, and it kind of led me into this crazy adventure. You know, it wasn't something I planned, in other words. So
sure, but there something must have been itching in the back of your head, even unconsciously, to just push you down a different route. Because you could have been Miami Steve until the end of time and played that role, and that would have been that, and you would have been
very happy and very rich.
Absolutely. Yes. But it's like, but look, you're rich in so many ways that it's
yeah, no, through, no,
through
I,
the,
I don't,
through
I
your don't, thumbprint on the world is that's not nothing.
I don't regret it. I mean, the nice thing about writing the book was going back and really reliving those days, you know, cause I don't look back. I really don't. Mm-hmm. So I had to really force myself to, you know, transport myself back there. And I think in the back of my head, all these years, I've always thought, you know, if only I could have stayed in the band and still done these things, you know, mm-hmm. and still done Sopranos and Lilyhammer and the Sun City Project, and, you know, and when you go back and relive it, really, you realize it's ridiculous. There's no
you can't do both. No, no. You can't be two people. No. You'd have to be two people at once.
Yeah. And, you know, can you imagine, you know, going to your friend Bruce Springsteen and saying, listen, by the way, I want to try being an actor for 6 months. You know, would you mind, you know, putting the band on hold, you know,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Take a vacation while I see if I can be an actor or not, you know? So, I mean, those things would not have happened. I don't know what would have happened, but certainly those things would not have happened. So,
yeah,
so
you got to pull the net. The safety net has to go away at some point.
Yeah. Whether you like it or not, you know, whether it's comfortable or not sometimes. And in this case, like I said, it wasn't really a choice. I had to do what I did. And so you look back now and I feel a little better about it, to be honest. You know what I mean? I felt like a burden was lifted from me all these years of having guilt, you know, guilt about leaving when I did, you know. So, you know, the book served a good purpose for me, too.
Mm-hmm. And also I should say to Jason, Pat, and Mike, you can ask questions by all means.
Yeah, I just want to hop in real quick. The one thing I loved about the book is there's so much sage wisdom throughout it that just resonates with me in terms of just, you know, how to live your life in the best way possible. And I don't know if you probably don't remember this, or maybe you do remember this. I met you backstage in 2003. In Richmond, my radio station that I was working for at the time was 105.3 The Bear. They were one of the first affiliates for Underground Garage.
Oh, nice.
And I interviewed you on that station. We talked a lot about like the Beatles and the time you guys did the Joe Strummer tribute on the Grammys. But backstage, one thing you said to us that has stuck with me as a comedian and just as a performer in general, is my friend asked you, you had done so many signings, you were hanging out with us backstage, and you're getting ready to go up on stage, and my friend asked you the question, he said, you know, Steven, you're doing all this backstage, you're giving so much energy and spending so much time with all of us, don't you feel tired? And you stopped him in his tracks, and I remember this moment, it's like the air was sucked out of the room. You stopped him in his tracks, and you said, tired? There is no tired. The stage is a sanctuary.
Hi, everybody. Tim Heidecker here to let you know about our latest episode of Office Hours Live.
Office Hours is great fun.
With the great John Early and Theda Hamill.
Very handsome.
Thank you. They're here to talk about their new movie, Stress Positions. And we just had a wonderful time. There was a lot of laughter and joy. Don't believe me? Well, listen for yourself on the podcast app of your choice. You're not going to want to miss a second. That's at Office Hours Live at the podcast app of your choice.
Bum, 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 bum.
I love Vic and Doug, and I love drinking my wine.
And I think of that every time I hit the stage as a comedian now. It's like, he's right. He's right. The stage is a sanctuary. There's no reason to be tired out there. And I actually take that sort of wisdom and live it through my life in terms of just being like grateful and doing the thing every day. And is that still like when you hit the stage today and, you know, is it still the sanctuary to you?
Yeah. You know, it's funny because people say to you, you know, oh, you're going to go on tour, you know. That's a lot of work, you know. Yeah. And I say to them, you don't understand. My work begins when I leave the stage.
<laughs> You know? Yeah.
On stage, man, I'm fine.
Right. You know?
I'm in my protective, you know, my womb, my, you know, my little bubble there. And there's no, you know, safer or better place to be than on stage with the E Street Band, you know, and which is an advantage us band guys have over you comedians. Which,
oh, completely.
You know, I don't know how you do it. Believe me, I have nothing but respect for what you do. But you know,
if it's not going well for a band, you can always just turn it up a little louder and hide behind that. You can't do that when you're just talking.
No.
Yeah, but you also got, you know, the other guys, you know, to you know, to commiserate with if something's going wrong, or right, you know, or to celebrate with when things are going right. You know, so it's. Yeah. Yeah, I've been a band guy my whole life, but anyway, that still holds true.
That's great.
I think, you know, being on stage, you know, once you do things for a long time and you really become comfortable with it, you know, Any place where I don't have to think, you know, I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. It's literally a mental vacation for me, and pure energy, an energy exchange with an audience like that. You know, you can't get it anywhere else. We've all missed that for the last 2 years, oh, Lord, you know, yeah. You know what I mean? You can't substitute for that. And you know, you're out there and for me, that's the reward, you know, the performer part of my life. You know, I hate to sound, you know, ungrateful about it because, you know, believe me, I get the two greatest jobs in the world, a rock star and an actor, you know. But those two jobs are, you know, that's the vacation part of my work. I don't even consider that really my most intense work. You know, I'm a writer producer, you know, I'm all about creativity and that's the work. And that's where you got to dig down and you got to think and you got to research and you got to do all this stuff. You know, the performance part, you know, whether I'm acting or whether I'm on stage with a band, you know, that's just nothing but fun. I'm sorry, you know, you know, and I look at it that way. And that's why I've always done something else. You know, I've always, since I first got on stage, you know, I've always done something else because I need to do something else to be satisfied and feel like I am in some way realizing my potential, you know, which I think is the purpose for all of us on this planet. You know, you got to find some ways of realizing your potential, whatever it might be, you know, and it's never going to be just performing for me, because it's not enough for me. Some people it is, and God bless. I'm not putting it down in any way. But for me, it's just I need the writing and the creation and the producing. You know, and I just love the fact that I've been able to produce radio, produce TV, produce a Broadway show. You know, I produce a lot of different things and create a lot of different things and write a lot of different things, and that's satisfying for me. That's you know, that just feels more satisfying.
Mm-hmm. There's a spirit throughout the book that I guess maybe anybody who's grew up in New Jersey or lived in New Jersey can kind of relate to, where you're kind of like, because from my perspective, I'm born and raised in New Jersey. You look up and you got New York. You look down and you got Philadelphia, and both of them think they're better than you. So you're kind of like sandwiched between these two places where both think that you're just this garbage in the middle. But that also, I feel like, gave a chance to like learn stuff off the grid, to just like get good at stuff without everybody looking at you, because you're not in New York yet, or big. You're not in Philadelphia. It's a huge big part of it.
Big.
But it also helps to have just this chip on your shoulder too, that you're like, I know you guys are looking down at me. And that spirit, I think, runs through the book. And I think it's a New Jersey thing. And to me, when you go in the studio, there's like, and you just kind of dictate how the horn part should go in 10th Avenue Freeze Out. And you'd only been in the studio, what, one other time at that point in your life? Yeah. So you go in, but that to me is the most Jersey thing I could think of, is somebody going and saying like, no, it should be like this. And you're telling the Brecker brothers how it should go. But you're just like, where's that come from?
Well, it comes from stupidity, of course.
Well, that's New Jersey also, then. That's,
it comes from being completely naive and stupid and not realizing, you know, that you're in a studio and what you say really matters, and you're dealing with the greatest horn players in New York. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, a little bit of naivete, you know, goes a long way. But, you know, you're right about us, the underdog thing. I mean, we definitely have that underdog thing. And the nice thing for me is, you know, nobody ever sees us coming, you know? I mean, that's how we got away with Sun City. Nobody saw us coming. You know, what the hell are these guys going to do about South Africa, you know? And we just kind of, you know, and that's been the case with really all of our success, really. It was the same thing with Bruce, same thing with the Jukes. Mm-hmm. You know, we just kind of, as you say, you develop kind of out of the spotlight. mm-hmm. which is very, very helpful, man. Very helpful, you know. And development is what it's all about, which is why I really am concerned about the younger generation. I don't know how on earth they can focus on anything long enough to achieve greatness. It's a big, big problem, you know, because it is all about development. Mm-hmm. Nobody's born great. Nobody. You know, greatness is developed, and it's developed over time. It takes time. And there's no shortcuts, you know. And man, with the amount of shit coming at kids these days, I don't know how they're going to ever focus on something long enough to achieve that greatness. It's a real challenge, I think, for kids now.
Yeah. Steven, this is Mike.
Hi, Mike.
Jersey, longtime fan and resident of New Jersey as well. I enjoyed reading about the Teach Rock program. I'm a product of public schools in New Jersey, and the music programs that I went through were sort of barely there. I got in trouble one time. I was sent to detention for playing the rhythm sticks. Those rhythm sticks were calling my name, and I started banging away. Next thing I know, I got detention. So I appreciate what you're doing to, you know, have a substantial program for music, because it wasn't really there.
Well, it's music history, you know. I mean, yeah. that's how we got away with it, because the all the music classes in America got canceled because of the No Child Left Behind legislation. So when the music teachers came to me and said, "What can we do about this?" I went to Washington and I asked around and I came back to them. I said, I'm sorry. There's nothing we can do about this. Okay, kids may never have instruments in the classroom again, because when Washington screws something up, they don't fix it very quickly. So we'll have to find other ways to do that, and we have with Little Kids Rock and different things. But I decided let's do something again and sneak in the side door, so they don't see us coming, mm-hmm. with a music history curriculum. And this is something that we can do cross-curricular. We can do it in history class, English class, music class, you know, all different disciplines. And we can do it with every student. This doesn't have to be musicians. So it's even better in a way. And the purpose being, you know, to keep the arts in the DNA of the public education system, which was in great danger of being eradicated. It was eradicated, you know, and I'm like, more important than a kid playing an instrument is a kid being aware of art and being able to experience art in all of its forms, you know, because I believe that that is something that works on a different part of the brain and also really helps the other disciplines. So our mission became not just something that's an after-school special or something on the side. Our purpose is to integrate the arts into those disciplines, mm-hmm. you know, integrate art into science, into math, into technology, into engineering, and turn, you know, the basic system of STEM, you know, science, technology, engineering, math, into STEAM, adding the A of STEAM, you know, and that's what we've been doing, it really helps kids get comfortable. They're not all comfortable with the really specific precision of math or science. You know, they want to be a little bit more comfortable with that stuff. So, the arts really helps that, because there's no wrong answers in the arts. First of all, you know. And second of all, it helps connect dots. You know, the way we do it with our curriculum, it really helps connect the dots and achieves the most important goal, I think, which is to teach kids how to think, not what to think. You know, and I think that's what's going to be important in the future. So, we just got into it, like I said, like everything in my life, by accident.
Yeah.
You know,
it's funny when you talk about hearing you talk about this, it's the same approach you took when you went into that studio and said how you thought the horn should go. It seems like there's always this thing where you see the thing very simply, and you talk about it through the book, that you're a problem solver. You see, you can figure solutions out to problems, and then it's just the hard part is that you now have to jump in the pool and hand your life over to fix it, to getting these things on the table and talked about.
There's two problems with that gift. And I do have that gift, which I didn't realize till late in life, of troubleshooter and being able to solve very complicated problems. The two problems are nobody wants to hear advice, period, ever.
Yeah, that's a biggie. Yeah.
And I can't apply these wonderful solutions to my own life, you know. Other than that, it's great, you know. But I discovered this whole other part of my brain. I can look at very complicated political situations, and like I can figure out the solutions to it. Mm-hmm. It's just one of those things. Now, whether those solutions get executed, as you say, that's another story.
They call that physician heal thyself, I think, is what you have to deal with. You can fix it for everybody else, but at some point you got as many problems as anybody else.
You see the big picture. I mean, even in these political situations, like the Sun City portion of your book, I absolutely loved, because you saw how all that was going to play out and you had to get everyone on board to do that. The one thing that was really striking for me, I'm a huge Queen fan. And a lot of the Queen books, when they talk about the Sun City performance, they gloss over it in a way where Queen kind of just says, well, we didn't know. And then that's it. They move on to Live Aid or move on to the Kind of Magic tour. But your book was the first thing I've ever read as a, 30-year Queen fan that said, they were concerned about their position in it. When you had that meeting with Queen to say, look, I'm going to take care of this, just promise not to play there again. Who did you meet with from Queen, and how did that process go?
You know, I'm going to remember this, but I got to tell you the truth. I was never a Queen fan, so I didn't
it's know fine, it's very fine. Well. I'm a big enough one for everyone.
I think it was the guitar player and drummer, I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
I know it wasn't Freddie Mercury, but I think it was the guitar player and drummer. Yeah. And it was a little bit more complicated than that, because there was this very, very serious list that the United Nations was keeping.
Right.
It was a serious blackball. I mean, they weren't joking around or trying to hide it. Mm-hmm. If you were on that list, man, that went out to all of the unions and everybody else who was into that subject.
Right.
Not so much in America, because we didn't know anything about it in America. But in Europe, though, the unions were very, very serious about this.
Yeah.
So there was a possibility they were going to have trouble working. Anybody on that list was going to have trouble working. So, that was another reason, I think, why they probably met with me. But I was working with the UN all along, and they started sending everybody to us. I mean, they only had like one person in the office. And so they were sending all the phone calls about apartheid to us.
Yeah.
But I managed to get everybody off that list because for that exact reason that you said, I said, look, they were manipulated. They didn't know.
Right.
Let's give them the benefit of the doubt. You know what I mean? Well, what are we going to do? We're going to question their motives? No. Let's just give everybody the benefit of the doubt. I don't want this to be a distraction. I want all of the music people all united behind this, And we succeeded, except for Paulie Simon, which is another matter. But.
That stuff with the photo in the book, that was my favorite part of the book. When you brought that photo up, I was like, good for you.
But we did succeed in uniting everybody at that point. And they were manipulated. They really were. So right. It was, and paid a lot of money, anyway, we wanted to give everybody the benefit of the doubt, and it all worked out well.
That's great.
Hey, Steve, this is Pat. I'm also a longtime Jersey resident and a fan of yours. My dad grew us up on Springsteen and going to shows and, first one being the 99 reunion. And from there, I got into punk rock and kind of, fell in love with that genre. When I was in college, I did a documentary on CBGB's closing down, and I was, we spoke a couple times on the street back then, and, I was really just, I'm still impressed with the fact that you stepped up and rose to the occasion. And on the celebrity front, you were really one of the only people that in, from the rock world was saying, you know, let's try to do something about this and save this place. And, you know, I always appreciated that. It was a tough fight.
It was a shame because I'm very, very, very serious about the sacred sites of rock and roll. And, you know, there's no respect for them at all. I mean, they're all going away. Very few left, you know, just a few, like, you know, the Roxy and Whiskey in L.A. They've managed to keep theirs. But most of the other ones are going away. And I feel very strongly about that in terms of the history. And they came to me too late. You know, it was we put up a pretty good struggle at the 11th hour, but it was really too late. And we did a concert. And the most fascinating part of that whole experience to me was when I put the word out that we're going to do a concert to, you know, try and save CBGBs.
Washington Square Park.
Yeah, it was either Washington or Tompkins Square Park.
It was Washington. It was and Day of All Days. It was the day. It was the day after Hurricane Katrina hit.
Oh.
I remember that.
But I just remember, you know, when I put the word out, the first two, you know, responses I got was from, you know, RZA, Wu-Tang Clan, and Chuck D from Public Enemy, you know? And I was like, man, that's interesting. You know, and I said, yeah, did you guys, you know, play CBGBs? I mean, it's not what I would have thought. And they were like, no. But it just turns out that the really, really smart hip-hop guys have an enormous respect for rock and roll. And they know that that's where their thing comes from, that the, you know, the attitude and the rebellion, you know, part of what they do, they know comes from rock, and they have a great respect for it. So the first two responses I got was you know, Wu-Tang Clan and Public Enemy to save CBGBs, you know, and I'll always remember that as fascinating, you know, and of course, you know, we made a big point of uniting, you know, hip hop. It wasn't called hip hop yet, but rap and rock on the Sun City record, which was a big moment in terms of establishing credibility for this new thing called rap that the industry was trying to squash and trying to ignore, you know. And I was like, man, I've been watching black artists fight for their own liberation in terms of their own artistic means of expression my whole life. You know, I watched Marvin Gaye, you know, fight with Berry Gordy and Stevie Wonder, and very few black artists were encouraged to express themselves. Very few. I mean, you can count them on one hand, the ones that broke, you know, that managed to do it, like Gil Scott-Heron or The Last Poets, you know. But in terms of the mainstream soul, R&B, rock, the black artists were not encouraged to express themselves, and the white artists were. It was part of the expectation of being an artist, a white artist. Of course, you were expected to, you know, be Bob Dylan, you know, but they didn't want Bob Dylan influence wandering into the black community, you know, which was really, you know, interesting to watch. And so here comes these rappers, and I'm like, finally, you know, these guys are expressing what's going on in their communities, and I want to support it, you know. And luckily I had three other guys with me, you know, Danny Schechter, who was the only reason why anybody ever heard of Sun City, and Arthur Baker, whose phone book was Sun City, and Hart Perry, who videotaped it all, or else nobody would have seen it.
That's and that video, we were all, that music video with the rap element, I think really helped catapult it to the next level. And it was really one of the earliest, you know, rap music video to feature rap artists that really broke through the mainstream. I don't think it gets a lot of credit for that.
I know. It was really a important moment, you know, and Jonathan Demme did a great job, and Godley and Cream did the edit, and they invented the ripping of the newspaper, you know, that was all invented for that video. And of course, everybody worked for free. So it was really miraculous. The entire project was a miraculous event that couldn't be done now. And I'm glad we did it when we did it. And the fact that it ended up politically so successful, literally bringing down the government and getting Mandela out of jail, you know, was almost beyond what we could have imagined. But we certainly, you know, drew it up on paper, and that's how it worked out.
I got to ask too, in all your travels, world travels, from everything that you do, since CBGB's closed, have you made it to Terminal C by chance in Newark Airport?
No.
Have you not seen what's there? There's
Terminal
a
C in Newark Airport?
Yeah. There's a CBGB restaurant in Newark Airport. Terminal C. you haven't seen it.
So I guess you did it. You kept CBGBs alive. It just happens to be in Terminal C now. If you want to fly United, you can swing by CBGBs at 8 in the morning, I guess.
But now they're a brand?
Yeah.
Only there, apparently.
Yeah.
And do they have bands play?
No, they have a delicious smelling chicken sandwich. I've never tried it, but I've smelled it from the food court area.
Sure. You know, just like that famous chicken sandwich at CBGB's. Now, I wonder if the bathroom is the same at Terminal C as it was at CBGB's. Yeah. That'd be a bad news. That was a rough bathroom.
Yeah, famous. Legendary. Now,
one of the things that also comes through in the book is your sense of, I guess I would call it, showmanship. You clearly, you know how to inhabit the role of telling people a story. You're a storyteller. You're a showman also. You're still a person. So you kind of have this, you combine those two things where you're talking about real things that really happened to you, but you present it. There's a sense of, to the way you tell your stories, because you know how to hold an audience. And where do you think you learned that skill set to know it's like, hey, I can tell a good story and you're going to be on the edge of your seat waiting to hear where this goes?
Well, I can only think of two things. First of all, growing up when I did in a Renaissance period, when when things were really, really exciting and fun and colorful all the time. In addition to having very high standards as far as the quality of the work, it was also very, very, you know, very, very colorful and fun. And the only other factor I can suggest is I just can't believe how fucking boring everything is. I mean, how did life get so fucking boring? I don't get it. Honestly, I look around, I'm like, man, you know, it's a shame because nobody, you know, anybody who's younger doesn't realize how boring it is, but man, is life boring, you know? And I don't understand it. I don't understand why we tolerate it. You know, why don't all the rich, really rich people do some fun things with that money? You know, okay, they're going to the moon now and stuff, you know, but, you know.
Sure, no, but Francis Coppola says the only reason you want to have money is to do something with it. He said, otherwise, well, money's worthless.
Exactly. And I'm looking around like, why isn't there more fun clubs and, you know, restaurants and casinos? I've been trying to build a rock network in the Hard Rock cafes now for, you know, I don't know how long, 10, 15 years, you know, trying to reassemble some kind of infrastructure to support rock music or any music for that matter. But, you know, they have the perfect infrastructure for it. You know, they got 150 of them, right, whatever it is, around the world. I keep trying to get them to put in a PA system, put in a stage, and you know, let bands go from hard rock to hard rock, you know. You know, and Jimmy Allen, the guy who runs the Hard Rock for the Seminole Indians, you know, he's he's an adventurous guy. I mean, he built that very, very cool guitar hotel down there in Fort Lauderdale. I don't know if you've seen that or gone there yet, but let me tell you something. It's impressive. You pull up to that thing, man, you see this 500-foot guitar. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. Architecture, you name it, I mean, why can't we all be influenced by Gaudi, in Barcelona, or somebody that's got some kind of creativity? Why is everything so damn boring, So, I mean, that's part of it too. You know what I mean? Sure. I never liked rock music evolving or devolving into the regular guy look. I never liked it. It is what it is, And it's something that, it worked, for a couple of guys that worked, John Fogerty and then Neil Young kind of got into it. And Bruce kind of got into it even, and they can do that and it works, but the entire, the thing about punk that was different than grunge, for instance, punk still had traditional rules applying. They had a look. They were very, very much tied to fashion, and the entire rock world was tied to fashion, right up until recently. Right up until grunge, really. up until the 90s, fashion played an enormously important role in all music, rock and soul. And it's because what we do is one big communication. It's not just music. It's not just music. That's the most important part, but it's also, the fashion, the clothes, the hair, the lighting, the production, all of that is one big communication. And that's why, the Ramones had a look, the Pistols had a look, the Clash had a look, the Dead Boys had a look, They were very conscious of having a look that goes along with the music. And that's why they were the best, Sure. They were the best,
What those bands needed would be if the 75 E Street band showed up, you'd have all those guys would have been wearing some pretty sick hats. You'd have Nirvana would have been, they would have all had hats on. No band ever wore more hats than the E Street band in the mid 70s. You guys could have sold hats at the merch table.
we went through our own evolution there. Uh-huh.
Where'd you get that first hat? That first one that you were like, that first Miami, the Miami, like the
real pimp hat?
Yeah.
Yeah, the whole pimp look. It was coming from the James Brown soul music guys. Mm-hmm. They all had that. They pretty much that kind of thing. And
when you put that first one on, where you did it, just it did it feel like the look showed up for you?
Well, we were still searching for our identity at that point. We wouldn't really start locking in until Darkness, in that 78 period. Mm-hmm. Then you start to have a, find our identities,
Yeah, because to me, it's like the look at that point was in 78. It's like Bruce started to wear that jacket. It looked like the jacket you'd wear if you had to wear a jacket to court. Like he had to get like one nice jacket to wear to court so he'd look like he'd being respectable to the judge. And like that would be his only jacket, the one he had. Like that's the vibe that gave off then. You guys had your own sneaky look going on.
But that was a big, big symbolic jacket, though. It was oh, yeah. Keep in mind, I went into great detail of this in the book, which surprised me. I didn't intend to really analyze anything having to do with Bruce. Mm-hmm. But I ended up, because at the time, I did not analyze what was going on. All I was concerned with was making great records. That's it, mm-hmm. But looking back on it, I was able to actually analyze for the first time what happened in between Born to Run and Darkness and his complete transformation, his complete identity change. Mm-hmm. after he had success, which is unusual. You know,
that was a really poetic part of the book. I thought that part was beautiful because you're talking about you crack the code and then you throw all of it out. And the way you phrased it was beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. That was a surprise to me, you know, because I realized, you know, because Bruce and John Landau, his manager, would go into these very long conversations, you know, and we didn't know really what it was about, you know. Mm-hmm. And so to really, really discover that, you know, 50 years later, whatever it is, was a revelation to me, you know, and I realized, wow, he went 180 degrees from that character he was creating in Born to Run. And the guy, you know, grab the girl and jump on the back of the motorcycle and let's leave these Tempest Town of losers.
Yeah. You know?
To suddenly, no, I'm staying.
When you made that sense of realization for what Bruce's journey was, but you had your own sense of artistic growth and development, what were the realizations you were making for yourself as you got better at this and you kind of had your feet planted? You weren't a tourist anymore swinging by the studio. This is where you live now. Like, because especially for somebody who's in that role of the number two, the concierge, the one who's facilitating and helping the vision come to life.
That's a pretty big question, actually. I was one of the consiglieres. You know, I mean, John became.
You were the only one with a guitar. You were the one with a guitar.
We kind of had separate jobs in a way. I mean, they overlapped certainly. But I focused more on the music, and he focused more on the content, you know, and that's why in the end it was quite successful artistically. I think Bruce was wise enough to have those two extremes kind of working for him, you know. So it became, you know, producing an artist is a big responsibility, and in that case, you know, it required, you know, two guys. You know, we were full time doing our jobs. We're usually, you know, you would do it all as a producer. Usually, you know, you deal with the content, you deal with the songs, you know, you deal with the band and the music, you know, and everything. But in Bruce's case, it was such a big ambition that he had, you know, to literally change music, or to not change it, but to take his place in that river of you know, the continuous the continuum of what traditional rock is and was, you know, to take your place as a third generation guy. You know, we had, you know, we weren't expected to do anything as important as the first two generations. The first generation invented it in the 50s. Second generation took it to the highest possible level, you know, in the 60s. So by the 70s, we were no longer a monoculture. And I talk about this. We became fragmented. And so, you know, at that point, it's all hybrids. And, you know, there was no great expectation as to what was going to happen artistically. And Bruce decided that, you know, there was something, there was another evolution that could take place. And John Landau was a very big help in that, and as I talk about in that section, how Bruce took all the other art forms and was able to use those other art forms in this art form, and therefore thereby was the evolution and his place as a third generation artist contributing greatly to what this art form could be at a time when everybody thought there's nothing else you can add. You know, at that point, you know, so that was a, you know, big surprise.
How do you think, because now it's like, obviously it's obvious the story has been told and the band got more successful and stayed and has made this insane footprint on history. but the reality of being in entertainment in the music business is like, what if it didn't go past, what if it ended with Born to Run and just it didn't click past that? What do you think your life would have been if that was, if it just didn't keep going?
I would have went back to the Jukes probably.
Okay.
You know, I mean, that's my first thought. I never intended to make solo records. That, again, that was just an accident, you know, that took place.
Yeah.
But I probably, that's my first thought. I probably would have went back to the Jukes.
Mm-hmm. And you'd just been kind of just playing the same, a similar role. Of just the idea guy, the vision, like somebody who's got vision.
Yeah, it was a bigger role. It was a much bigger role than I played with E Street Band. I was doing everything. I was writing.
You were the manager, basically.
Managing it, writing it, arranging it. You know, I was doing everything and co-lead singer. So it was actually a much bigger job. Now, you know, and we probably would have went further than we did. You know, the Jukes would have probably been a little bit more successful had I done that. I made the mistake of giving them to, you know, my personal lawyer to take care of. And, of course,
it's my favorite part of the book. You're dancing around right now. My favorite part of the book. You could have just released it in an appendix in the book of who still owes me money.
Oh my God! I mean, I took out. I took out at least no more. I took out about 2/3 of the assholes of my life. You know, I really did. You know, I didn't want. I left a few just for spice. You know,
you got to get a second book. You need. You got to keep a final. Call your next book the final third.
Because you know, I don't remember. No, final 2/3. 2/3.
Final 2/3. He said he took out 2/3.
Oh, you only got 2/3. Oh, you only.
He's got two more books.
Then you got two more books.
Two more books coming.
No. I mean, I didn't realize it myself till you go back and start living your life, you know, one year at a time. And I was like, oh yeah, I forgot about that asshole. You know, yeah. There was that one too. You know, and in the end, I was like, I don't want the book to be negative. You know, a lot of negative. You know,
I think you struck just the right tone with it because you put enough of that in that it's a real. You're being truthful, but it's not just you settling scores.
And believe me, it's easy to make a memoir into revenge.
Oh yeah, look.
Nothing but revenge. I mean,
that's the next book.
That's a constant temptation. Uh-huh.
Yeah, well, now your jersey's really showing. I guess we can do final questions for everybody, and then we'll let you get on with your day.
Let me just mention I had a terrific editor, Ben Greenman, who great publisher, Ben Schaefer at Hachette. Both of whom, you know, kept an eye on that stuff, you know, making sure that, you know, I didn't, you know, overdo the negativity. And I told Ben Greenman, I just want an equal balance between three things. I want the narrative. I want the history, you know, because I witnessed it all except the first generation and the craft stuff. You know, that's what's most important to me, a balance between those three things. Because in the end, I wanted the book to be useful, you know, my story. You know, the narrative is the least interesting part to me. You know, I wanted to make sure we got the craft stuff in there and the history. And you know, and I think we managed to get a good balance there. So I want to, you know, thank Ben Greenman for that.
One thing you mentioned.
I just wanted to ask.
Go for it, Mike. Do it, Mike.
I just wanted to ask, Stephen, you're such an ambassador for rock and roll. If you had to give a State of the Union address in 2022, where are we at with rock and roll?
We have returned to the cult that we were in 1955. It's a little bit healthier than that, but not much. Mm. And the infrastructure, which lasted the solid 30 years, of the rock era. I clocked the rock era from Like a Rolling Stone to Kurt Cobain's death. That 30-year period was an anomaly in history. I think it'll be looked back on as a blip on a radar screen. You know, the fact is we probably belong as a cult. We never belonged in the mainstream to begin with, probably.
Yeah.
So, you know, but we're back to being a struggling cult. And I've dedicated the last 20 years of my life to try and make it a healthy struggling cult where people can possibly make a living doing it. And it's been a real challenge. And we have introduced over 1,000 new bands on my radio format, 1,000. And, you know, maybe 3 of them make a living doing this, you know, know, White Stripes, The Hives, and Rising Suns, you know, I don't know, and not too many others, you know. But we're always encouraging those little threads of, you know, that go out there. You know, we try to get bands into festivals, you know, or you know, they find a way to tour on their own somehow and sleep on people's floors, you know. I don't know if you read the Dave Grohl's book, which is terrific. You should read it. You know, Dave Grohl goes through that whole thing, which I didn't talk too much about those years, but Dave does a lot of detail about the struggling years of sleeping on people's floors, you know. You know, so that's happening again, and you can't stop it. You know what I mean? There's no reward whatsoever for playing rock and roll anymore. And when was the last time you heard a rock song in the top 40? I mean, I can't remember it, whatever it was. You know, it's decades, you know? And there's no, you know, there's not a lot of reward for doing this anymore. And yet 1,000 bands are doing it. And that's just the cream of the crop. We play the best of the best of the best. So you got to imagine there's 100 times that amount out there. Why are they doing it? It's purely out of passion. There's no other way to describe it. There's no reward at the end of the rainbow anymore. None. So, but yet they're still doing it, which makes you want to support them even more, you know? So it still exists. You can't stop it. It's one of them things that just, it's out there and it's going to always be there, I think. And it's a matter of us working a little bit harder to try and establish a new infrastructure that can support it.
My final question, Stevie, is this. When we chatted in 2002 on my radio show on 105.3 The Bear, we were talking a lot about the Underground Garage, and you were so excited about the sheer number of Rolling Stones songs that you guys had in your playlist. Have you just gone ahead and added the rest of the catalog since then? It's been 20 years since we spoke. Did you just throw the rest in there?
Probably, yeah. I haven't checked lately.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's just one of those bands that, well, we should say, you know, in all fairness, that there's very few. I could count the songs on one hand. That I didn't like from the Rolling Stones up until, you know, the first 12 albums.
Right.
You know, and even, you know, you can get, you know, even into Goat's Head Soup and even into, you know, It's Only Rock and Roll, you know, still stuff, you know, but, you know, I'm mostly an exile and back,
right.
You know, and my favorite period is the first period. You know, that's stuff I love. You know, my favorite album of all time is 12x5, their second American album.
You can always gauge whether it's Brian, whether you're Brian Jones, you're a Mick Taylor or a Ron Wood. Or that's always right. The giveaway. It's like, tell me which one's your favorite.
Yeah.
And then you get a read on the person.
But I would imagine we have almost all of the first 12 albums on the playlist. So, you know, pretty much. You know, just a handful that are not on there, but yeah. Quite a few. Yeah,
I figured as much.
Yeah, and they're the only, you know, and they're the only band we play slow songs. We don't play any slow songs from anybody except the Stones, who I think are the greatest, really the greatest rock ballad writers of all time. Mm-hmm. You know, it's only like them and, you know, occasional Smokey Robinson, or you know, an something exceptional from the Temptations or something, you know, in the soul music area. But rock wise, you know, there's nothing, nobody compares to the Rolling Stones when it came to writing ballads, which of course they were embarrassed about in the beginning. That's why they gave away As Tears Go By, and you know,
yeah.
But you know, no one's ever going to be Tell Me, you know, one of the first songs they ever wrote. So it was one of the great ballads of all time for me.
Mm-hmm. Oh, without a doubt. Pat, do you have a question?
Stephen, I loved the writing of the book. I've been a fan of your radio show for many years, and you know, the historical, you know, educational kind of monologues that you have written over the years and done on the show, I've learned so much from, and they're so great.
Oh, thank
so,
you.
So those portions of the book, I've really, really loved and learned so much, and how they tie into your life. One of my favorite lines in the book, and this goes to everything we're speaking about, was "Don't take bands for granted. They are magic." And that is so true for whether you're seeing your favorite artist or your new favorite artist or discovering music live, or whether you're playing in bands. I think that is just so true. The way you described the 78 shows on the Darkness Tour in chapter 12, and how you and the guys wanted to, your goal was to leave the audience with an experience they'd never forget for the rest of their life. And how that was the goal coming out of this hibernation Bruce had been in at that point, you know, with the legality of everything, and how you guys had to deliver. My dad went to the Passaic Theater show, the first opening night show in 78, the one that was broadcasted on radio and everything. And he had never even heard of you guys or seen you guys before that. This is exactly how he described that show to me always as a kid. He said it was an experience he'd never forget ever again. He was a lifelong fan. And he went out and bought everything he could after that show. It was just like, it was literally described to me as life-changing. So like when I read that in your book, I mean, it just rang, you know, so true in my head to everything he described it as and everything I've heard. I know Tom has been going deep on listening to that era as well and getting his hands on live shows and stuff. It's just, I mean, you know, you listen to those shows, they jump off the needle, basically. You know, they're so, it's just like, you know, white heat. I mean, I don't know. It's, I guess it's less of a question, more of a statement of thanks for delivering in that time. It's really, it's a moment of music history that's, you know, not talked about as much, but it's a legendary set of shows.
Yeah, I think it became a little bit taken for granted after that, but that was the moment. The reason why those shows were different, well, that was the moment that, you know, we discovered Substance. I mean, Bruce discovered Substance for himself, and that's the difference, as opposed to. That's not really. I'm trying to be accurate here. Not Substance in terms of the content, which there was plenty of substance and content on the first three albums, but I would have to say autobiographical substance. I think that's what made the difference, because by then we were very entertaining. You know, we had gotten very entertaining and the fun part of the show and the, you know, that the excitement part of the show we had down. But this new bit of, I think, autobiographical substance gave the show just one more level of depth, I think, at that point. Now it's taken for granted now. You know, our art form happens to be, I think, the most autobiographical, at least in terms of that's what it seems to be, you know, in terms of the audience's perspective because the person who is writing usually and singing, it becomes, you know, it seems to be a more autobiographical art form anyway. But it's not really. It just seems that way because every singer is an actor, which I talk about in the book. But in this case, I think that the real substance that Bruce was going through himself of this amazing transformation towards no longer having his father be the enemy, but turning into his father, or you know, at least certainly having the compassion to understand his father, was, you know, was a thing we were all kind of experiencing because of the generation gap of our generation. But there it was for the public to be seen for the first time. So I think there was a difference, you know, there was a qualitative difference between what was happening Born to Run and before, and Darkness and after. You know, that's why I you know, people were surprised when I said Darkness on the Edge of Town is actually Bruce's first album. You know, they were a little bit surprised to hear that, but that's the truth. It's because it was a different level of commitment at that point. You know, where, like I say, you're not getting on the bike and leaving town. You're staying, mm-hmm. and you're going to fight it out. And you're going to fight for the people who can't fight for themselves. You're going to fight for the factory workers all of a sudden, you know, rather than be afraid of them or running away from them. You know, the horror of growing up and being a factory worker was something that we all grew up with. You know what I mean? That hippie mentality of like, man, I do not want to grow up and be my parents.
Yeah.
You know? That's the last thing I want to do. You know, the 9-to-5 grind, you know, of doing something you don't want to do. It was a horror to us, you know, it was a horror. And suddenly it was like, well, wait a minute, you know, let's not blame them for that. Let's have some empathy and sympathy. And that was a completely different, you know, frame of mind, different sensibility. So some of that, I think, started to come through.
Absolutely. I've always loved Darkness for that. I always saw it as like a, that just that, you know, he left town and now he's fucked. He has to face reality. And it's like, it's life. It's just, it's one of the hardest looks at life that he's ever had. And it's beautiful. I mean, it's my favorite record. So thank you.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Are you looking at it that way? Or he didn't leave town.
Right.
You know, that's how I look at it. He decided not to leave town, you know, and deal with the town as it is, you know. That takes a lot of courage, and Bruce had a lot of courage at that point to tell an audience, thank you for accepting me and liking me and liking this character I created for Born to Run, but I'm sorry, that's not really me. You know, uh-huh. I hope you forgive me, but I'm about to become a completely different guy.
Sure, yeah.
And fortunately, we had the muscle and the songs and the intensity to make that transition.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I my final question, I'll ask in 1 second. But to me, it's always been that's the point where you all. The influences weren't wearing you. You became bigger than the influences from that point onward. It just like it became its own thing. You carved out your own path that you could say we're the only ones doing this, and this is kind of the starting point for a new thing. It's not just like here are all of our influences and we are interpreting them in our way. It's just like, to me, that's why I could see why you also consider that the first album.
Yeah, because like I said before, development takes time, and sometimes you're going to do it in public, you know.
Yeah,
you know, and that's okay. That's all right.
Well, here's what I want to ask you. Final question, and again, we appreciate you so much coming on and talking about this. And the book is amazing, and everybody should check out Unrequited Infatuations. So we got songwriter, producer, manager, actor, frontman. Writer, director, activist, Broadway producer. Like what is one thing that is in your mind? You're just like, there's a place I haven't gone yet. What's one goal that you haven't taken a crack at yet?
Well, I don't know if I'll get around to it because, you know, at this point, you know, I'm limited to what I can do. I mean, that's the one nice thing about having success early, and what would have been nice had I stayed in the band is the opportunity to do things would have been much greater in terms of getting things financed. So that's the one sort of thing that, you know, nothing you can do about it, but that's one of the things that you miss and you regret. Because there is no doubt in my mind, my greatest achievement was the Broadway show, because I got a chance to use everything I know. And I love that the most, the writing and producing of a live event, you know, and everything that goes with it. You know, I talk about in the book, you know, I would love to have been, you know, in my mind, you know, a Diaghilev or a Bob Fosse or, you know, somebody who, you know, I love the whole thing. I love the music, obviously, the choreography, the costumes, the production, the lighting. I love all of that coming together, and that communication. And I've only done it once in my life, and it's very likely that might be the only time I've ever done it. I might eventually put out. We did film it, which is, you know, it's not the same thing as being there, but we might eventually put that thing out. You know, I just want to wait for a couple of the, you know, certainly one of the scumbags to die first. But
there it is. There's the.
Other than that. Uh-huh. But that's the thing I miss doing, and I wish I had more of an opportunity to do stage live events, you know, which is the most exciting thing you can do, and have all of the elements, all the arts, you know, used. Sure. You know what I mean? That's you know, that's the one thing I wish I could do more.
Okay. Well, I will say this: Unrequited Infatuations is your All That Jazz. You told the story the way Fosse told his story. You told yours. I'm so glad you did it. And we appreciate you writing this book, and we appreciate you coming on and talking about it. So thank you so much. It means a lot.
Good talking to you guys. My pleasure.
Okay. Thank you so much.
We'll see you soon.
Thank you.
Hey, take care.
You. All right.